this very moment, thousands of philosophers, artists, and writers are turning over in their graves. For yet another college freshman or high school history teacher or university professor or yes, even beloved podcast host has oversimplified his profoundly complex and sophisticated ideas. There they are, rolling around 6 feet underneath the Earth's surface, while we have a good time upstairs lazily reducing their ideas into cliches for our own meager purposes. Know thyself, Socrates once said. Is there anything else we need to know about him? Not really. It is better for a prince to be feared than to be loved, Machiavelli wrote. I think that suffices as far as Machiavelli goes. Admittedly, I am exaggerating here. After all, Socrates also did once say that the unexamined life is not worth living, right? So there was more to him, if only a bit. Our culture has been seduced by books like Philosophy for Dummies, by 101 courses on the Renaissance, by 30-minute YouTube videos containing Heidegger's entire contribution to metaphysics. On the other hand, these types of low-hanging fruit learning methods are highly valuable in allowing us to dip our toe in the waters of heavy, dense topics. Yet, on the other hand, this overview, quick and dirty approach often, indeed almost always, dilutes these theories and texts so thoroughly that they become distorted almost beyond recognition. Any course which has 101, for dummies, overview, introduction to, beginner's guide to, should be treated very, very skeptically. It is too easy, too overviewy. Many people would put The Shrift in the same category. After all, it is a podcast which is known to reduce Kant's entire third critique or Rash's interpretation of free will to a 4-minute explanation interspersed with laugh tracks. Do not listen to them. There is absolutely no problem with getting all of your cultural, literary, and philosophical knowledge from The Shrift. In Season 1, Episode 15 of The Shrift, Parasha Bo, I coupled Hegel's theory of a historical dialectic with the Israelite exodus from Egypt. While it felt good, damn good, at the time to be able to encapsulate the Israelite exodus in Hegelian terms, I began to wonder down the road if, perhaps, it could really be that easy. I recalled that I had never actually read Hegel's theory of the historical dialectic. I just had heard various professors throw around the term over the years. Surely, Hegel's three-step theory of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis could not be that easy. To help figure out what I might have missed, overlooked, and oversimplified, I decided to invite Professor Yadi Oren onto The Shrift. Dr. Yadi Oren received his BA in philosophy and psychology from the Open University of Israel. He received his PhD from Bar-Ilan University, and he wrote his dissertation on the philosophy of the German philosopher Fichte and the ancient Greek philosopher Plotinus. Yadi was also awarded a postdoc from the Franz Rosenzweig Minerva Research Center in Jerusalem. His expertise is in German philosophy in the late 18th and early 19th century. He has published extensively on Hegel, Fichte, Maimon, Rabbi Kook, and Kant. In addition, Yadi, born and raised in Israel, is also a practicing Jew and a scholar of Torah and Judaic studies. I was introduced to him by a mutual friend at a Shabbat dinner several years ago in Berlin. My friend said something along the lines of, "You have to meet this guy. He likes the same weird stuff that you do." Since then, Yadi and I can often be found at the Shabbat dinner table of Lavi Olami in Berlin, discussing Kant, Kafka, and Hegel whilst taking sporadic bites of challah. Yadi, welcome. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Sure. You did your PhD in philosophy with a focus on German philosophy, but you're also a practicing Jew and regularly at the synagogue. And how do you balance these? Do you ever feel like, why am I studying Kant and Hegel when I could be reading more Rashi and more Rambam?
Yeah, it's a good question. But if you mention the Rambam, for example, he thought that it's essential to deeply study Aristotle in order to understand the Torah. So when he was really young, he translated Aristotle into Hebrew so that people will know this philosophy in order for him to have rational tools to interpret the Torah in a deep way. I think it's the same. So
he knew Greek, I guess, Rambam.
I think he translated it from Arabic
okay.
Because this was the standard back then. But
still.
Yeah. I think it's the same. When I studied the history of philosophy, I felt like the post-Kantian philosophy has greatness in it, which I did not receive in the yeshiva. So when I learned in the yeshiva, at the beginning I learned only Talmud, but then I realized that I have more interest in philosophy, so I dedicate more time to Midrash and Chazal, Machshevet Chazal, and to Maimonides and Jewish philosophy. But when I came to more deeply learn classical German philosophy, post-Kantian philosophy, I had the feeling that people who learn Rambam and do not take this philosophy into account, I mean, there is some kind of a gap. I mean, you cannot rely on the Rambam after you have Kant and the critique of pure reason or the critique of traditional metaphysics, because Rambam is working in this framework of traditional metaphysics, and after Kant all of this changes, and so our understanding of Judaism changes. And
Rambam was working based on ancient Greek philosophy, Aristotle, like you said, and Kant revolutionized or fundamentally changed, gave us a totally new perception that wasn't available to Rambam. So, that's crazy. Yeah.
And for me, for example, my dissertation was about Plotinus and Fichte, both non-Jews, not very popular. But for me, Plotinus represented metaphysics that was similar to that of the Rambam that I learned in the yeshiva, while Fichte was representing the post-Kantian, after the revolution of the critique, how metaphysics should look like after that. So when I'm not going to go into what I did there, but if we take these two thinkers, and I think they have a similar starting point, but they work in within the framework, Plotinus worked in within the framework of ancient or traditional metaphysics, and Fichte within the new modern anti-metaphysics or critical metaphysics. And for me, it was the way I understand Judaism anew through Fichte, through Kant. This was the same project. How do we understand the concept of God, the concept of unity, the concept of being? I mean, all those concepts transform greatly between traditional metaphysics and modern metaphysics. And for me, it was essential because I felt like Judaism, as it is learned, if you learn Rambam and you take it seriously, and as I took it when I learned in the yeshiva, it was my own beliefs. And you don't take Kant into account. I mean, there is a gap. And for me, it just, for example, when I learned about the concept of unity, it's not only in Maimonides, it's Chovot HaLevavot. I don't know how to translate it. It's the
obligations or needs
of the hearts.
I'm not sure. Needs of the heart, or chovot has something to do with like a debt, or
maybe
owing debt, something. Yeah.
So he begins this book with a really broad discussion of the concept of unity, and I studied it, and I.
Sorry, who was this? That
this is Chovot HaLevavot.
No, but who wrote it?
Bechayei Ibn Pekuda, Rabbeinu Bechayei Ibn Pekuda. I think 200 years before Maimonides, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
So he begins his book with a broad discussion about unity and what is the unity of God that we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Eloheinu Hashem Echad. What is this unity? This unity is not the unity of I have one finger or I'm one person. And when I studied it, I took it really seriously, and I mean, it was of great influence for me. And then when I studied that in critical philosophy, I mean, after Kant, there is a critique of this concept, because this concept is thought too objectively without taking into account the subject. I will not go into that, but I mean, I felt like the sky fell.
Yeah.
The day it happened, because this was the set of belief that I had before, or I'm not sure if beliefs or the whole conceptualization of the very basic Torah that we learn changes. And for me, it was dramatic.
Is that like controversial at all, because that no other sages kind of substantiated this or verified this way of reading the Torah? Like, is that problematic that you're doing it without the allowance maybe of the sages, right? Without the permission of the...
Yeah, so I mentioned the Rambam, and he is not controversial, but I think in the 13th century there was a great controversy about the Rambam.
Yeah.
Because of his philosophy.
Okay.
And you're right that there are other approaches in Judaism. We know that Rabbi Nachman Mibraslev he didn't allow his students to read Moreh Nevuchim. He said that if he sees someone that read this book, he sees it on like a bad mark on his face.
Which, but this is a book that Rambam wrote?
Yeah, the Guide for the Perplexed.
Guide for the Perplexed.
Yeah, so that's what Rabbi Nachman said. And he was against it, any philosophical understanding of Judaism. There is also a comment of I'm speaking now of the Hasidic side, also from the Mitnagdi side, from Lita, the Gaon Mivilna, also criticized Maimonides for being for philosophizing Judaism too much.
I know way too little about Rambam. I remember hearing once, which is where I unfortunately get most of my knowledge, is just hearing other people tell me things. That sounded bad in that context, but anyway, said to me that Rambam said like the miracles in the Torah are just ideas, like just they didn't really happen. They're kind of, they shouldn't be taken literally. They're just concepts, like, and that's that it's for basically smarter people can read the Torah and know that these miracles were just kind of just ideas. They didn't, is that true? Like, I'm just trying to understand why Maimonides was so controversial, or why it's bad to read the Torah philosophically, just for our listeners that might not. Because if you say to me, oh, read the Torah philosophically, that doesn't sound so, why would Rav Nachman be against that? Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, what you're saying, I'm not sure what you're referring to. Maybe it's true, but there was an attempt to rationalize miracles.
So Rav Nachman, did he believe that the Torah just should be taken at face value? Like, everything is exactly how it's written, there's no...
Well, he advised to not ask too much and to live as simple as you can.
Ah.
Maimonides has tried to be very scientific.
Scientific, rigid, or
And consistent.
Rigorous.
Rigorous and consistent.
And when you're rigorous with the Torah, it can open up Pandora's box, we might say, and create all kinds of questions that maybe Rav Nachman and other don't want people to ask, because there might not be satisfying answers at first.
And more than that, the very question is problematic, because it makes you more than what you are. You pretend, or you become, the way I understand Nachman, you become arrogant. You think that you should know, whereas everything you need is around you. You don't have to go deep into discussions that are not in your capability.
Well, that's a very fascinating philosophical question in its own right.
Exactly, and this is the... people say that Nachman is part of the existentialist...
Oh, really? Makes sense. Maimonides was sort of... his eyes were opened up by Aristotle, and that allowed him to read the Torah in a new way. And now Judaism, we need another... Now that Kant's philosophy has... And his followers, Judaism is asking us to read it again anew, the way Maimonides did. And you see yourself as part of this... You're inspired by this idea. And
yeah, that's why I don't want to sound too pretentious here, because people did it before me. I mean... people like Hermann Cohen and Cook and other people tried to do this. But I feel, from what I read, that there is still work to be done in this direction.
Hegel's theory of the dialectic, or at least my version of his theory, viewed the Tenth Plague in revolutionary terms. This was the moment in which two historical forces collided: Pharaoh's drive toward slavery, the synthesis, and the Hebrews' drive toward freedom, the antithesis. But that is the problem with revolutions, and even with the word revolution. They become too easily romanticized. As Bob Dylan once sang, "There was music in the cafes at night, and revolution in the air." Or as William Wordsworth once wrote about the French Revolution, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." But wait a minute, what actually happened here with this Tenth Plague? Was it so lovely, so romantic, so Wordsworthian? In fact, the Torah states that at midnight on the 14th of Nisan, a great cry could be heard throughout the land of Egypt. This was the cry of the dying of the, quote, "firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne, unto the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. There was not a house in Egypt where there was not one dead. Unquote. In short, if there were ever a bloody revolution, it was this one. Is it time to stop sugarcoating the 10th plague? Let's find out. You are listening to The Shrift, Interview 15 with philosophy professor Yadi Oren. Bo. Plague was different from the other nine. If we are making war analogies, which I think we are, it can best be compared to an atomic bomb. The first nine plagues were drone attacks, targeted missile strikes, and embargoes. These were plagues like those blasted frogs hopping around everywhere, or the blood-turned river, or the swarms of locusts hovering in the skies. These first nine plagues were so horrible that, indeed, the Egyptian pharaoh reluctantly granted Moshe's wish to let my people go. But only for a moment, only for a moment, for these nine plagues, terrible as they were, just were not bad enough. They spared civilian lives, spared innocent lives. Each time, the pharaoh, as we say, hardened his heart, changed his mind, and refused to let the Israelites go free. All of that changed with the 10th plague, however. At midnight, on the 14th of Nisan, the angel of death killed each and every firstborn son throughout Egypt. It did not matter how cute or rich or evil or old or innocent this firstborn was. The angel of death happily took all of them. With one abysmal midnight cry, thousands of souls fell instantly to their death. Because the Hebrews painted lamb's blood over their doors, however, the angel of death passed over their houses. Passed over, as in Passover. Get it? Just like when the Americans dropped the atomic bomb on Japan, the 10th plague got the attention of the evil dictator in a way which none of the more targeted, civilian-sparing attempts had. The country that would never surrender finally surrendered. Or did it? In fact, even though the pharaoh did at last relent and let the Hebrews go, he changed his mind again a few days later and sent his chariots off to hunt down the Israelites. Standing on the banks of the Red Sea, the Hebrews were sure that they would be slaughtered by Pharaoh's army. But the Red Sea parted, the Hebrews walked across land to the other bank of the sea, and the Egyptians, caught in the middle, drowned to death as the waters crashed down upon them. Now safe on the other side of the sea, the Hebrews sang a victory anthem, celebrating their freedom and reveling over the drowned Egyptian soldiers. The 10th plague freed the Hebrews, much like the atomic bomb ended the war with Japan. Now, thousands of years later, how do we feel about this 10th plague? When we sit around the Seder table, should we celebrate it, mourn it, or do something in between, perhaps commemorate it?
So my question to you is, just about the plague itself, without talking about Hegel, we'll get to that later, is this not a genocide, right? Is this not basically just killing innocent people? Obviously, from the Hebrew perspective, this was advantageous, we might say, because this is what allowed them to leave. Nothing else was working, and this was the only thing that worked. And we can also compare it to the atomic bomb, right? Like, I can remember my grandfather, he fought in World War II, against the Japanese. And his favorite president until he, for his whole life, was Harry Truman, because he dropped the bomb and got him out of the war. And I remember one time my brother criticized Truman for dropping the bomb, and my grandfather got very offended, very angry. Of course, if you ask, you know, maybe a Japanese person, they think Truman is horrible. So from our perspective as Jews, this was advantageous, to say the least. But if we look at it from the other perspective, like, is this not a genocide? What's your take? And you don't have to, I mean, I don't, you don't have to give a yes or no answer, but maybe at the very least you can explain why, as Jews, we celebrate, or why we don't sufficiently mourn this event. Does it receive enough compassion from the Jewish side?
Yeah. First, there is an interesting detail of the story, that the plague was supposed to be on everyone, including the Israeli. Everyone should have be subject to this plague, but the Jews were told to put the blood on their doors, and that's how they got saved. So the plague was something like nature. That's how it was. That's how the Torah explains it. It's not something that God did purposely on Egyptians, but it was supposed to be for everyone. I think it has a meaning, this detail.
What, is this in the Torah that it's?
Yeah. That's why they have to do the Pesach. The original meaning of Pesach is that you slaughter this lamb, you put the blood on the door, and then the angel who comes to kill will ifsach Pesach.
Passover. Will,
Passover, yeah, exactly. Passover,
in English we say Passover. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it has the meaning. Maybe later we'll...
No, I understand. Yeah, it's sort of... It was going to happen to everybody. It's sort of like a...
It was not against the
it's
Egyptians.
A plague.
Yeah,
like exactly. Like COVID something or natural. Something. Yeah.
And two more points that I would stress before getting into discussion is, first, that the term genocide is a bit anachronistic in this sense, because we are not familiar with ancient world. And as evidence, and this is the second point, how did the story begin of Sefer Shmot? It begins with the command of Pharaoh to throw every born boy to the water, to drown them down. I mean, this was only the answer. So the word genocide is something that we are shocked about today. In antiquity, it was not so uncommon as it is today. And even you said in your story, the difference between the perspective of your grandfather and your brother is the feeling of, maybe the Japanese will take over and they will cease to be America, or they will cease to be the free world. This is a feeling that, as someone who was born after the war, you never know. And this is a different perspective only of a few ten years. But if you think about today and like the world of 3,000 years, 500 years ago, it's like another planet. We don't know anything about the world. I mean, in antiquity, back then, it was common. If you had a handicapped baby born, you would put it for the birds to eat it. This is a world that we cannot grasp today.
Yeah.
So genocide is I mean, they did it all the time. It's horrible. It's not less horrible. But if you think about it, yeah, historically, it was necessary. In such world, it's necessary to act in this horrible way.
So based on the moral norms of the time, it wasn't so unethical or immoral to kill a proportion of a particular race, we might say, or ethnic group or nationality. Okay, I get that, but what I want to ask now is, because we are living, obviously, in a world with much different moral norms, as you just agreed, where we don't celebrate any... I mean, it's not morally acceptable to celebrate other people dying, usually. And this is just my own personal experience with the 10th plague at Passover Seder in my family and, you know, friends, like, there's no mention, there's no sadness or mourning for what happened when we at the Seder table about the 10th plague. The Seder table is generally a happy, festive event, and we have a ritual where we name the 10 plagues. At the very least, it's neutral the way we name them, and I would say it's celebratory.
But we do it as if it is blood.
Okay.
I mean, we take
our pinky in the wine and make 10 drops.
We know it's blood. It is blood that is spilled.
Yes.
This is symbolized, as I understand it, it symbolized the price, the horrible price that had to take place in order for us to be released from Egypt.
Okay, so you don't see it as, you see it as a commemorative...
Yeah, it's not a celebration. This act is mourning, or I would not say mourning, but it symbolizes blood spilled. This is, cannot be a good symbol. I mean,
yeah, positive. That's true. Do you think it would be appropriate at the Seder to say, hey, we should have a moment of silence for all these
these... I would not say, yeah, it is relevant today, because these people do not, for 2,000 years they do not anymore exist, those Egyptians.
Yeah.
The Egyptians today are not the same people. So I'm not sure it would be relevant, but...
Don't you think it sends a bad message? I mean, I would say it sends a message like, hey, all these people died and we don't care. I mean, I know they're dead a long time, but just for like the way we think about human life and the way we think about animal life also.
So there is this Midrash,
yeah,
who speaks about the moment in which the Egyptians afterwards, when they chased after Israel, yeah, and maybe you can say to
they chased them and the Red Sea parted, the waters parted, and the Hebrews walked across on dry land. The waters were like two walls, and they got to the other side, and then the Egyptians came after them in their horses and in their chariots, and the waters closed on them and they drowned. And then and then on the other side, Moses sang a song, a very really reveling in the death of these Egyptians. It was a I would say jingoistic song, taking pleasure in the death, in their death.
I wouldn't say it. Okay. I'm not sure. I think
we're celebrating.
Maybe also we have a different perspectives, because you grew up in America and I will grow up in Israel.
Yeah.
But the feeling of being in life danger and being relieved from this danger is something that you have to sing about, because otherwise you do not acknowledge what happened. You have to sing about, I don't know if So someone you know were in a terror attack, and he survived. And you just you know that the other people were murdered or the attacker, but you don't think about it because you have to celebrate the fact that you're alive or your friend survived it. But what I said before that the Midrash, so Israel are singing and praising God for saving them. But the angels, parallel to Israel, they also sing and praise God. And then God stops them and says, my own deeds, the creatures of my hands are drawing in the sea and you are praising me. This is inappropriate. And he stops them from singing. And what the Midrash says, this is not a critique of Israel, because Israel do it from their own perspective of the one who were saved. The one who is saved, the first person perspective, should always praise God for that. But the angels have a third person perspective. They see both sides. And that, I think that's how Judaism shows this complexity of multiple perspectives. The one who survived must praise God for surviving. But the angels who haven't, like, they see it from above. They see the whole historical event from a perspective not of one who is living it, but from one who is watching it.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And they cannot sing. They cannot praise God for it.
Hegel's philosophy of history is attractively, seductively simple. History moves dialectically. Two opposites collide and a new order is created. The monarchism of the Ancien Régime in France collided with Jacobinism and thereby gave birth to Napoleon, the sweet spot between the two polarities. In fact, as I have already stated several times now, this theory is too simple. It can't be this simple, can it? Because a small child could have read a History of the World book and developed the same theory. Many years ago, I listened to a lecture from the Great Courses on Hegel entitled Hegel's Philosophical Conception of History. In my naivete, I believed that this 30-minute lecture was largely all I needed to understand, well, Hegel's philosophical conception of history. I mean, that was the title of the lecture, after all. I distinctly remember the professor bringing his lecture to a climax with the quote from Hegel, "The owl of Minerva flies at dusk." The professor wished to emphasize that, for Hegel, history can only be understood and evaluated in its aftermath, years or even centuries later. During the daytime of history, when everything is happening, Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, is still asleep. I did not know in which context Hegel made this assertion, or whether I even agreed with it, but I latched onto it and held onto it for years to come, and perhaps even into the present day. After all, it was so simple, so obvious, so usable. The owl of Minerva flies at dusk, I found myself saying whenever I wanted to bring clarity to a thorny debate about history, or really about anything. And yet, I sort of always knew, deep down, that it couldn't be this simple.
Again, I learned this from a kind of audio course, like intro to philosophy. Remember he said that Hegel was born in 1770, and he lived through a very tumultuous period of history. He died, I think, in 1830. So, sorry, 31?
Or 32, yeah.
Okay. So, born in 1770, 1789 was the French Revolution. And this was a revolution against... Hegel was born in a world... He wasn't living in France, but everyone was aware of what was going on in France.
He saw Napoleon.
Yeah, well, I'll get to that. France at this point was the center of Europe, and it was a world of monarchy, kings, queens, and then you had the peasants, had basically no rights. And you also had the clergy, but we won't get into all that. And 1789, and you had this revolution, right? Where the people demanded liberty, equality, fraternity. And you had the terror a few years later, 1792, where essentially the royalty were overthrown. King and queen were beheaded. Hegel is 22 years old. He's watching all this happen. And in the ashes of the French Revolution, as you said, came Napoleon. Let me just take a step back and just explain this in Hegelian terms as I see it. Hegel had a concept of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So you have in history, and again, I could be totally wrong about this, but you have one historical force, the thesis, another force, and they collide together, and then comes a third kind of reconciliation of these two forces. In terms of the French Revolution, which Hegel lived through, you have monarchy, world of monarchy, and then you have the world of, I guess, democracy or republicanism, which is what the peasants want. These two collide in the revolution, and then out of this comes Napoleon, who he was sort of a monarch, a dictator, but he also believed in...
Enlightened.
He believed that he had the Napoleonic Code, which gave rights to the citizens. So yeah, I mean, in other words, Hegel saw history as this kind of force, counterforce, and then a new order. And because he lived through that, this was his kind of dialectic of history, that history moves in this dialectic from one pendulum swing to another, and then comes a new order out of these two extremes. I know that I'm sure that Hegel is turning over in his grave right now as I say this, and so many Hegel scholars are probably would be outraged at what I just said, because I know it can't be that simple. Maybe you can, what did I get wrong here, or what didn't I get wrong?
First, I must say that I'm not an Hegel expert, although okay. I wrote on Hegel, and although I'm reading a lot of Hegel, I would not say I'm an Hegel expert, because I feel like Hegel is an ocean.
Yeah.
And for me now, maybe in the future I will feel differently, but now I feel like he wrote about everything.
Yeah.
And he wrote so much, and his thought is really complicated. So in reference to what you said first, I think the first thing that a student of Hegel learns is to take out of the vocabulary the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, triad. Because Hegel did not use these categories. Actually, they were before him. Fichte uses it a bit. Also, this is also not Fichte's dialectic. Sometimes when you see Hegel's dialectic, you could subject them to these three categories, but Hegel never uses it. So what happened is that Marx and Engels were much more popular than Hegel himself. And Engels, in his interpretation of Hegel, that's how he explained Hegel. It was so easy So it became really common to attribute these categories to Hegel, although he did not use them.
Right. I read the Communist Manifesto, and it's about how you have these class warfare, right, between peasants versus the landowners, and then in modern times it's the workers against the businessmen, so to speak. And that, right, so they use this theory to, I guess, justify a communist revolution. Yeah, and communism is much more well known and popular than Hegel,
for sure. Exactly. And yeah. Also, because Hegel was not the first to introduce history into philosophy. It was something that was done in his time by Herder and other philosophers. Mm-hmm. But Hegel did it in a more systematic way, in a more rigorous way. And I think his lectures on the history of philosophy are one of the clearest works of his. And I think the most popular one. And so some people even treat Hegel as a historiosoph, they say, as if his philosophy is only a philosophy of history, mm-hmm. and not a philosophy that stands on its own. And this is completely false. Hegel is first and foremost a philosopher. His contribution is to logic, to metaphysics, or anti-metaphysics, it depends on the interpretation. But, I mean, he has this fate that other philosophers, like I worked on Fichte did not have this fate. Most people do not know who he is. But because Hegel had influence on people like Marx, who became world known outside of philosophy, then the works of Hegel that helped to understand Marx or influenced Marx mostly became the first thing that people know about Hegel. Although it's a bit for a philosophy student, it's the other way around. I mean, I would say that his lectures on the history of philosophy are not the most interesting ones.
Okay. So, just to stay with Hegel a little further, I mean, I know you're, if, yeah, I heard Hegel said, "The owl of Minerva flies at dusk." I don't know if you've heard this quote, that essentially what this means is, as I was taught, that in history, we don't know in the middle of history whether it's going to be good or bad, so to speak. Minerva was, of course, the goddess of wisdom. And Hegel wanted to say, like, let's wait. Let's look at the bigger picture. Let's see what happens in the future. Only then will we know if Napoleon was good or bad, or if the French Revolution was good or bad. So, is this a fair assessment of Hegel's philosophy, in this sense?
Because I think of the history of philosophy.
Yeah.
In general, I would say that the dialectic, his dialectic, turns from the unity of a thing, if I explain it plain words, the unity of a thing with itself, through which it develops the difference. Because if you try to explicate things, what it is, every category that we have, if we try to explicate it, we discover its what different from it, and then there is a tension between them, which turns back to can say to a bigger unity that includes both, and the whole process leads to self-consciousness, to getting to know. I mean, the whole process is a process that goes outside in order to go back inside, but this time while being aware of the self. And this quote also expresses this, that the aim of the process is self-consciousness, that the spirit of the world that develop throughout history comes to know itself. It comes to know itself in Hegel thinks, in Hegel's philosophy. Because after going through all the process, the last step is to get to know the process. This is self-consciousness, and this is the all of Minerva.
So that goes to what you were saying before, that Hegel was more interested in philosophy than history.
Yeah.
And that this dialectic, he really was, or at least worked much more intensively on how it relates to the self.
Logic, the self, the self-consciousness, for example. So his first big treatise, in which he is already an independent thinker, not in the shadow of Fichte and Schelling, is the Phenomenology of Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a work that in which self-consciousness is in the center of it.
So at the very least, we can, I mean, he believed that you can't, you can't be in the middle of something, of self-analysis or of historical analysis. You can't be in the middle of the storm, so to speak, and be able to know what and assess it. You have to wait until you're out of it, and then you can look back on it. And that's, I guess, that's sort of the, this kind of, that's more of the dialectic than kind of the historical movements themselves.
Yeah, but you also has to recognize the mechanism of history throughout, because it's not just a series of events. You have to delve into the logic of history. And this logic is this, his dialectic, which finally comes to self-consciousness of the whole process.
So did Hegel believe that history was moving in a positive direction?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
The spirit of the world, which is reason, which is the good, develops and exposes itself throughout history.
Okay, so let's, I have a couple other, okay, and just something I'm curious about, like, why was Hegel so worshipped in Germany, actually? I noticed that so many people were so influenced by him, and what was the love affair with Hegel in the 19th century about? If you could just say a couple words about that.
Yeah, sure. You should also mention that many people hated Hegel for the same reason, I think.
That he was too optimistic or too...
No, it's not...
Oh.
I don't think that this is the reason. I'm not really familiar with the reception of Hegel. I mean, I know some of the thinkers, and but Hegel suggested... a method that managed to explain metaphysics, logic, aesthetics, morality, the history, the culture, everything you ever wanted to know about anything in the world can be explained within Hegel's philosophy. This is, that's why I said before, it's an ocean.
Yeah.
I think no one before him and no one after him suggested such a project. Without even saying with it whether it succeeded or failed, or I mean, partly succeeded, partly failed, but no one suggested such a project.
Yeah.
No one.
No one.
No one that we know.
Okay, well, let's do our own dialectic, so to speak. We talked about the 10th plague, we talked about Hegel, synthesis, antithesis, and now maybe we can synthesize them together. I viewed, when I did a Schrift a few years ago, I considered whether this 10th plague and this kind of collision between these two historical forces, one, the pharaoh being the force of despotism and the Hebrews being the force of freedom and maybe kind of democracy, or...
You said despotism?
Despotism. And then the synthesis, we had this collision, and then the synthesis maybe is when the Hebrews eventually got to Israel and could form their own government, obviously very much aware of their background or their history as slaves, but now as free people. What would Hegel say about this idea?
I think this is one of the advantage of his dialectic, that it enables so many different, also fascinating interpretations of the text. And what you said, for example, about the synthesis between slavery and freedom, and what is the relationship between them, and the relationship that the Torah tries to describe within the people of Israel, and that they cope with throughout their 40 years in the desert, when they are slaves and when they are, I mean, you see them sometimes they go. They act more as slaves and sometimes more as a free person. And when you asked about the tenth plague and about dialectic, I had a different thought, and it was the relationship between nature and humanity, because the basic problem in Egypt was that Pharaoh decided that these people will be slaves. Now, what gave me the thought of this interpretation is that the first plague is blood. The water become blood. And for me, I thought that it means that nature becomes a human body. This is the meaning of water become blood, because blood is. Mm. And what I understood that happens is that normally we take nature, and Egypt is the ultimate example of that. Nature is our slave. We know its rule, and we take it for our advantage. We don't have to give him nothing. Today, of course, we do. I mean, it's a different thought that we have today about the environment, but back then, nature is the slave of humanity. That's that also the Torah also said it, that
you mean that the Hebrews in their natural state are being
I'm talking more basically about men and Pharaoh before the Hebrew came. Pharaoh and nature were in relationship of master and slave. Then, when the Hebrews became danger for Pharaoh in his own eyes, he decided that the Hebrews would always also be slaves as nature. And what I thought that the plagues mean is that God shows Pharaoh, you think that nature and with it the Hebrews are slaves. I will show you that nature itself is not your slave. And what happens is that nature comes and show its free will. And you can see it throughout the 10 plagues, that nature has free will. You think that you are the ruler of nature. No, no. And the 10th plague...
Just want to... Sorry to interrupt. Why did the Pharaoh think that he was... He thought he was ruler over nature? Is that...
This is given to us. We always think that as human beings. Uh-huh. We are not... That was separates us from animals. Not all... I did this. I don't want to speak about animals, but we always think of that. We
maybe what, because of like the pyramids and stuff, or well,
the pyramids, the Nile, the way they use the Nile to for everything, and this fact is more emphasized with what Joseph did a generation before that.
Right.
With the 7 years, yeah. He managed to. Go into the logic of 14 years
with the grain 14, and
yeah, exactly.
Storing the grain and using it, basically tricking nature, so to speak.
Exactly. And man became the master of nature. And then Pharaoh became even more arrogant. He said, yeah, also people can be part of it.
Mm.
And what happens is that nature comes as a person and tells... I mean, God could have done, I mean, from the perspective of you think, he could have just taken them out, right?
Yeah.
He could have done a lot of different things, but we have to learn something from the process that happens here. And I think that's what we learn, is that this balance between man and nature, once you make people like nature, slaves... Yeah, it unbalances everything, and this is kind of the dialectic that I thought was happening here.
I interrupted you before you were going to say something about the 10th plague. Was that? Can you finish that thought?
So the 10th plague,
yeah.
Is the ultimate way man is subjected to nature, because we. Are also bodies.
Yeah.
And body can die like nature dies. And this is the last dependency of us on nature. And nature shows us this through
death. Is this your theory or did you hear this from somewhere?
No, I thought of it this year, but it became so clear to me when, I mean, I always didn't understand this. I mean, I always had the feeling of going to the river and feeling that it was blood. And I didn't understand this because it's a very strong symbolic plague. But I never understood it. And this year when I read it, I thought, it's a human body. Nature becomes a human body with own free will.
Interesting. Wow. Very relevant today, of course, because we've if we thought we had controlled nature then as humans, we really think we control it today. But then, of course, with climate change and it's sort of rising up against us. Yeah, brilliant.
I agree.
I'd like to just try to bring things full circle here. So it sounds like my theory does sort of maybe Hegel would have seen it as Hegelian to some extent. I don't think it sounds like you're not saying he would have said no. You're misusing my theory with this slavery, freedom, Israel. That kind of works.
So I'm not familiar with everything he wrote about Judaism. I know one early treatise that he wrote, the Fate of Christianity. No, it's the Spirit of Christianity and its Fate. And this is treatise which is very hostile to Judaism. He sees Judaism as a religion that hates nature, and for it God is only transcendent. There is no connection to anything. Basically, it's an isolation of the world, from the world, a religion that tries to isolate itself from the world. And Christianity is, of course, it's the opposite, and the answer to it
embraces all people. And
yeah, and God is also immanent within man, within humanity, because what he sees as the problem of, so you can see this dialectic here that idolatry says that everything is God, or like God is inside of the, we have gods everywhere. Then this is like, you can say, the first step. Then the
thesis.
Yeah. Although, as I said, Hegel does not use it.
Okay.
But so this would be the first a basic situation. Then Judaism would be its negation. And as negation, it does not have any positive content. It's only the negation of idolatry, which means Judaism only says God is unknown, we don't know anything about him, and we isolate ourselves from the world, because the world might be seen as the source of idolatry. And then Christianity comes and do the, what he called the Versöhnung,
synthesis or reconciliation.
Reconciliation, yeah.
Yeah.
Of the two.
Yeah.
When God, the one God, comes into Jesus' body, and that's how we have the unification of transcendent God of Judaism and the
earthly.
Yeah, the of an idolatry.
Right.
And this is exactly, by the way, what Jews throughout the history said against Christianity. They said, this is a mixture of idolatry and Judaism. This is not a monotheistic religion at all. Or it is maybe monotheistic, but it took some parts that are of idolatry.
Wow. And Hegel's actually saying that's actually
in a positive way.
That's the positive. That's
exactly
what Judaism needs, or yeah, what's missing in Judaism. Well, yeah. So, okay. So it sounds like I said that it sounds like Hegel did think in terms of these triads, and it's possible to apply his philosophy to these grand historical movements. Okay, good to know. How did Hegel feel then about these apocalypses in history, like the 10th plague, or like the atomic bomb, let's say, or like even might say the Holocaust? Like, what would Hegel say about these horrible events? Did he have a kind of the ends justify the means type of mentality about these horrific events? Like, well, that's okay because it will lead to the right thing in the end, right? Like, I think that's also very would be very Marxist, right? Like that.
Yeah, I also know it from Marxism, but actually, I don't have much knowledge about this.
Really? Okay.
About how Hegel treats disasters or pure evil that is explored. I'm not really familiar with this.
Okay. Well, it seems like, and I don't see how he could have rejected. I don't see how he could have. It seems like his philosophy lends itself to this, to a rationalization of these disasters.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we can't say for sure, but maybe our listeners can go.
Yeah, and also that he thinks that history is, they call it a teleological.
Yeah,
it has a purpose, and its reason that is being, or the world spirit, the Weltgeist, that is being fulfilled throughout history. So history as an end goal towards which it strives.
Sure. And I guess, again, existentialism sort of was somewhat affronted or horrified by these, by this kind of refusal to look at individual suffering or
this is,
I mean, that's another
a very
topic.
Common prejudice about Hegel, that he did not care about individuals. I think this is completely wrong.
Oh.
This is from people who maybe only read the history of philosophy but not other parts, because Hegel dedicates a great deal of effort to explain individuality. It is not that he thought of us as I don't know, people.
Ants.
Or not at all. I mean, so many discussions about self-consciousness and morality, and I don't think this accusation is right at all.
This is kind of, I guess, probably my last question, but it is sort of a big question. To me, this seems like a very simplistic, and you've already said that there's a lot he didn't even use, talk about synthesis, etc. But in general, I always felt, and you've already dispelled this idea, but this idea of the triad, that you have one extreme, another extreme, they come together. I know that you've already explained how it's much more complicated, but this to me seems like something a child could think of, right? And I always thought, like, okay, come on, like, Hegel obviously was a much more sophisticated thinker than must be. So what, can you help explain why a child wouldn't, why this is not a child, this is not a child's theory?
Yeah, so I prefer to explain it through a treatise that I worked on more, which is Hegel's Logic, Science of Logic. It's a treatise that he wrote from 1812. And I think it's a common view, it's the heart of his work. Everything else stems from this logic. Because
which
in the logic...
Which book is this?
The Science of Logic.
Okay.
And it's one of the most difficult books. Oh. But it... I would say that, for example, if you speak about aesthetics, logic... You say a manifestation of logic there. Or in history, or in morality.
Sure.
But the logic is the development of the logic itself without any other topic that is being manifested in it.
Yeah.
And maybe to explain Hegel's logic, we can I can refer to its beginning, how it begins. So I'm not sure if it if people know that, but in traditional metaphysics, philosophers used to think about what is being. And this was even considered the goal of philosophy, to understand what is being. The first philosopher to deal with it is Parmenides, and after that you have...
pre-Socratic philosophers.
Yeah.
Before but also, Socrates.
Yeah, but also in Socrates you have discussions about it. And Parmenides, when he analyzes it, he says that this being is all the everything that exists, and because nothing does not exist, then this being cannot involve any nothingness in it. So it is eternal and cannot change.
So there's nothing, so we know we exist because we're not nothing, sort of?
Nothing does not exist.
Right.
So he denied the possibility of becoming. Because he said, nothing does not exist.
Nothing does not exist.
And in order to have becoming, you have to have movement from nothing to being, right? This is becoming. But because nothing does not exist, you cannot have any movement. That's how Parmenides denied any becoming. And he said, we see becoming in the world. We see things that were, I mean, seeds become trees. But this is something of an illusion. That's not something that pertains to being in the real sense. Being in the real sense is something eternal that cannot change and is not in movement. And this understanding of being was... of course, it was challenged and it developed, but this is a thought that accompanied the history of philosophy for more than 1,000 years. Hegel begins also his logic with the concept of being. But he says, about what being do we talk here? We talk about plain being without any differences. What is this plain being? If you think about it, if you try to think about it, it turns out to be nothing. It turns out to be identical to the concept when we think nothing. Because if you try to think about being without any difference in it, what is this? This is nothing.
What do you mean by being just, I mean, you can't, not the word being, obviously, just existence.
Yeah.
Because if there's no content, then it's nothing.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It needs content.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this transition itself from being to nothing, and then if you, and then you can do it the other way around. Let's try to think about nothing. Try to think about it. Nothing, without anything, nothing exists, you will get to the same concept of being that you had before. So, Hegel says, being and nothing are actually leading to each other, which leads us to the concept of becoming. Being and nothing, in their most basic meaning, are concepts that lead to each other, and thus they lead to the concept of becoming. And that's how he refuted the whole Parmenidean tradition. Through his dialectic, and that's a dialectic that cannot be reduced to the categories of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Because the turn from being to nothing, and I know it is very complicated and I do it very short, but the turn that Hegel suggests in the from being to nothing is not from thesis to antithesis, but he shows that the first category just collapses into the second one. If you try to understand it, it turns out to be the second category. And this second category leads us to the third, which is becoming. And through this, through the concept of being, the same concept that begins from Parmenides, that so many philosophers used before Hegel, through his dialectic manages to derive from it a whole set of concepts. And this is the, I would say, Hegel's greatest achievement. The ability to derive from concept a whole series of concept, which is the dialectic.
So you have the pure being and pure nothingness are both essentially the same? They're the same.
The same.
Because they have no... They're both nothing. Pure being and pure nothingness. If they're the same, then why is there... And then becoming is the...
Transition
because... That's the part I'm not so clear on, but...
Yeah. I would recommend to read it because it becomes more complicated afterwards, but the beginning of Hegel's logic is like so brilliant. I mean, you read that and you don't understand. I mean,
Hegel's logic or Herder's?
Hegel.
Oh, yeah.
Hegel's logic. This is what the science of logic. And this is also a better example of how to learn what is dialectic, because if you learn it through the history of philosophy, it's more... I mean, you get into the content that is there, but not into the logic of...
Yeah.
And I think this is a better way to learn about the dialectic.
Well, you've certainly answered my concern that it's something a child would have thought of, because if no one since Parmenides thought of it, then I don't think an uneducated... Maybe a child could... In the wisdom of a child, but certainly not write it down the way Hegel did. Anyway, thank you for that answer. That's very helpful to know. So we're basically finished. Is there anything that I should have asked that I didn't ask, where you think, why isn't he asking me this?
No, I don't have anything in mind.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
I really enjoyed the questions, actually.
Yeah, me too. It was great to just have one-on-one time with you instead of at Shabbat, which is also nice, but a lot of distractions, and really get to hear. I feel so satisfied that you were able to answer my questions. It was really just great to finally get answers. I've had these questions for so long, so thank you for answering them so well.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yadi explained that, for millennia, philosophers believed that being and nothingness were worlds apart, that being could perhaps best be defined as not nothingness. Hegel's master stroke was to perceive that being and nothingness were not fundamentally different, but rather fundamentally identical. This was certainly not a theory a child could have devised. Not even a Wunderkind could have pondered something so otherworldly. When Yadi mentioned Hegel's book, The Science of Logic, which propounded this conception, I was intrigued to learn more. In fact, I was especially drawn to it when Yadi said that it was a short book. But then he implied that it was also rather dense, and indeed, hard to get through. Have I learned my lesson? Will I actually, read Hegel this time? Or will I let others do the heavy lifting while I cozy up with another Wikipedia article or YouTube video? Only Minerva knows.